morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of January. Professor Edie Hirsch, Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia and founder of Core Knowledge Foundation, is our guest the first hour of today's program. He's written a very interesting article in a publication that comes out quarterly, City Journal, and it's in the winter 2013 issue, in which he writes about the key to increasing upward mobility being the expansion of our vocabulary. The article is titled A Wealth of Words, and it goes beyond learning a new word a day, although I spent much of my life trying to do that, but that may not be the whole answer. He has recommendations for how it is that we should improve students' vocabularies and hence their economic potential. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls, I would imagine. We'll have more than a few calls on this. You like words, and I think what he says will be provocative. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can always use our email, talk@wpr.org, or access our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Hirsch, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for being so interested in my article.
I think it's really fascinating. And you asked the question, so let me start by asking you this question. Why should vocabulary size be related to achieved intelligence and real-world competence?
That's, first of all, that gets us a little bit into cognitive psychology, but I don't mind doing that if you don't.
No, I don't mind.
Well, the basic idea is, first of all, there's a correlation between vocabulary size and amount of knowledge. That is, and I use the example of nouns, which is the best example. Nouns name things, and you need to know what they name in order to understand the word. So vocabulary size obviously has some connection with the number of things that you know. And the number of things that you know is very important for your general competence in coping with the world. But there's another reason why words are, and number of words appear on regular IQ tests. There's always a vocabulary section. And that's because words are so fantastically efficient in putting into your short-term memory, which is a very small space, something that allows you to have a counter, a proxy, for a whole range of things that that you have in long-term memory. So the more words you know, the more you're able quickly to put things together. There's a lot of evidence that when you're using short-term memory, there's something called a phonological loop that actually uses words. I didn't go into all that in my article.
Right.
I think my editors would have taken it away, but you asked this sort of surprising question right at the beginning.
Sorry. But it goes beyond. I had a mom who made us, actually, I've said this before on the air, but she should have invented that word a day calendar that became so popular, and I buy one every year because every day when we were a little bit older, she would want us to learn a new word a day. And yet, as you write in the article, it goes beyond just learning a new word a day. It encompasses much more than that.
Right. And I have to say, if you, that's only 365 words in
that's
the year.
Right.
And a college-ready student, and it depends on how you count the words, but a college-ready student needs to know about 25,000 to 60,000, depending on your mode of counting words, whether you're counting groups or individual words, cognate words, and so on. But that's a lot of words, and so it would take you a lot of days if you're just learning one a day. As a matter of fact, general figure that you hear is that a well-prepared high school student has learned on average 15 words a day.
Really?
Yes. Well, you just do the math. If you have to have 25,000 and you start at age two, I haven't got my calculator by me, but that's a lot of words a day. But the thing is, you don't learn a word all at once. You learn little bits and pieces of words along a broad front. So you're learning a little bit about a lot of words if you're having a successful education.
You mentioned at the age of two, one of your recommendations in this article is that we really pay more attention to preschool education, that it's very important in order to have a fair opportunity to be able to make a living.
Well, it's particularly important for disadvantaged children. And I used some research from, it happened to be in France, but it's enormously interesting because it involves 2,000 young kids, whether it made any sense to start preschool at the incredibly early age of two instead of starting, as they normally do, at age three. And it turns out that it made a big difference, though starting at three is also a great thing.
You look, and you're well known for understanding educational systems and what it is we all should know. Let's do a little bit of history here, because you write about what happened early in the 20th century, this idea of training the mind through hands-on practical experience. The ideas began to spread, you say, and the test scores show the impact of these ideas in our educational system. From 1945 to 1967, you write, 12th graders' verbal scores on the SAT and other tests had risen, but then those scores plummeted. What happened?
Well, there were a lot of theories, and you know, the plummeting was the cause of a lot of fervor in the 70s and 80s, and it produced A Nation at Risk, which came out in 1983. What is the cause of all this verbal decline on SAT and ACT scores? And there were all kinds of theories. The advent of television, well, that wasn't a good theory because the Japanese actually were rising in verbal scores, and they watched more TV, the students did, than the Americans. And there were the main was we are now many more low-income students and minority students are taking the SAT. And that had a little bit of an effect, but it's been proved that was by not at all the chief cause of the verbal decline. One example was that in the state of Iowa, which was 98% white and middle class in attitude, the scores declined just as they did in the general SAT. There's a test that's given to every Iowa high school student, and those scores declined in the same way. It was the television theory, the demographic theory, but then people discovered that, well, look at the school books. The vocabulary is much less rich than it was before in school books, and the emphasis is far less on book learning than it was before. And that is now, I think, among people who study the issue, and particularly the sociologist Donald Hayes of Cornell, his predecessor was the great literacy scholar Gene Shaw. That's the theory that now prevails, that the schools were teaching less and using less rich language in their school books.
Would we notice that pretty dramatically if we were to pick up a textbook from, 1945 and compared it with a textbook from 1975?
Yes.
We would.
Well, you would notice it if you started counting words the way Donald P. Hayes did. and you computed, well, and you just made a list of the words in one case and a list of the words in the other, you would find a tremendous difference.
Well, does that help explain? I've always wondered why it was that people who lived in Shakespeare's time and went to see his plays, you know, were middle class or working class people, and we struggle with that language and all the metaphors and the richness of that language now.
But don't you think they would struggle mightily with ours?
Right, because of the technology.
Yes, I mean, and of course, Shakespeare is wonderful in that way. He's a very special case in that he was able to reach the pit as well as the nobility and highly educated people. But so there, because he's so many layered, and it's very doubtful, I think. I mean, you go to a Shakespeare play, and you certainly understand what the situation is, but only a few understand the nuance of language. I think it's, you hear it, it's magnificent, but it's, I bet that there was a diversity of understanding even in Shakespeare's time.
Mm-hmm. So what about the books now, Professor Hirsch? Are they better or about the same as they were in the 70s?
They're very similar. They have things called leveled readers, and children are given these leveled readers, and these things are usually rather dreadful in themselves, and their vocabularies are deliberately depressed, because the way you compute whether this belongs to a fifth grader or a fourth grader or a third grader is the rarity of the words used. So you don't want to have very rare words for young children, and you have more slightly rarer words, that is, frequency of occurrence in some computer-generated corpus of text. If you use more rare words, then that automatically lifts it up to the seventh grade level, and that wouldn't be appropriate. But that is actually scientifically unsound, and good linguists and cognitive psychologists don't really approve of that. But that's the standard mode of procedure now in our schools.
You write about vocabulary not just helping children do well on verbal exams, but studies, and I'd like for you to talk more about these, please, have solidly established the correlation between vocabulary and real-world ability. What do you mean by that? What's real-world ability?
Well, real-world ability, what I had in mind when I wrote that are studies that are done. There's something called the Longitudinal Survey of Youth, and sociologists have studied that for many years, and they followed cohorts of people. And similarly, the armed forces have correlated scores on tests with cohorts of military personnel. And they have very clear records that show that your score on the verbal section of the armed forces qualification test, which is what all people took in the Longitudinal Survey of Youth, that those scores correlated highly with job performance ratings, with income, with lifetime opportunities, basically. And it's that sociological work and work in the military which is some of the most solid connection between educational attainment and real-world abilities. And by the way, you started out asking about smartness and IQ. You know, there are two aspects to IQ. One's called fluid intelligence, the other crystallized intelligence. And fluid intelligence is what you're born with, and that's what most people think of as IQ. But in fact, real-world IQ is strongly dependent on education and strongly dependent on vocabulary.
And before we go to phone calls, because we have many, I want to make sure that we talk a little bit more about how we learn. You talk about, please explain this, it's not just building vocabulary, but there is a domain-based approach to literacy that is important. Can you describe what that is?
Well, yes. The way we learn words, if you are reading in a book about the Civil War, and you read that a regiment was annihilated. You may not, as a kid, know that word, annihilated, but then you read more and you see other occasions of the words, and you, because you know what's going on there, you know that all those soldiers were killed, you begin to have a sense of what annihilated means. And that is the way we learn most of the words we know. We learn them in context. And the other thing that has been found out and emphasized by cognitive psychologists is that familiarity with context speeds up your learning of words by a tremendous factor. Landauer is a good cognitive psychologist at Colorado, and he showed that at least by a factor of four, that's probably too precise to be dealing with generally, but it's just common sense that you're picking up word meanings in a familiar context much more readily than if the whole surrounding of the unknown word is also unfamiliar. So that leads to the idea, which has been confirmed in both in foreign language study and in literacy studies, that if you stay on a topic for a couple of weeks, children are picking up not only words related to the topic, but also general purpose words like however, nevertheless, and so on. You're picking all of those things up faster because you're guessing the gist of the passage. And so why not apply that systematically? That is, why not build up general knowledge, which is the key to vocabulary, systematically, and but at the same time stay on a domain instead of leaping from story to story the way it's done now in basal readers and literacy programs in a kind of ad hoc way.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. Professor E.D. Hirsch is our guest this hour, and we're talking about literacy, about vocabulary to reduce inequality in America. A good place to start is the language arts classroom and building a vocabulary. I found that fascinating that by the 12th grade, we know 25,000 to 60,000 words. How do we learn those words? How do we read to be able to incorporate rich vocabularies? What do rich vocabularies do for us in the work world, in how successful we are on tests and how successful we are in actually making a living? Professor E.D. Hirsch, Professor Emeritus of Education and Humanities at the University of Virginia, and very well known in this country as founder of Core Knowledge Foundation. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please avail yourselves of all of those opportunities to communicate. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Wednesday, it is the January edition of our Back to School Book Club. We'll be looking at Kate Chopin's The Awakening, which received pretty harsh reviews when it was released in 1899. She wrote overt descriptions of female sexuality, and the main character disdains the role of wife and mother that is prescribed for her in the turn of the 19th century New Orleans. We'll have two guests with us, our regular book club guider, Russ Castronovo, who's professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison, and Emily Toth will join us, a Kate Chopin biographer and professor of English at Louisiana State University. All right, we go to phone calls now for Professor E.D. Hirsch. 800-486-8655 is a number. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan is our first caller. Hi, Camille.
Hi. I will try my best not to lose my voice here. Let me just say, first of all, that I'm so grateful that you have this topic on the radio. There's no place else where, you know, you're going to hear this, and I really appreciate it. The comments I would like you to respond to are, first, that I don't think that our government is very supportive of the kind of program that, say, a linguist would would recommend. What I'm talking about is the fact that, say, with bilingual education, it is getting less and less attention. In fact, it was outlawed in California, and every linguist knows that a child needs to have a good base in their first language before they take on the next one. And so I think that's a real problem for underprivileged kids in this country. And the second comment is that in the Waldorf schools, they do not use textbooks until later. They create their own book textbooks in the younger grades, but the children study the classics later, and ultimately equal or surpass their non-Waldorf peers in testing. And I wonder if you could comment on those two things. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Camille.
If that's addressed to me, I guess I'm your only guest, but unfortunately...
It's for you.
Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the Waldorf curriculum, and so I can't speak to that, and I don't know the data that the caller refers to. As to the point about bilingualism, I've held the view for a long time, and there's some evidence to support it, that, as the caller indicated, you do not want to hold children back. But bilingualism is quite a bit different from the pattern of becoming more and more highly literate in your native tongue before you take on a second language. I don't think there's much evidence for that. I think that it's perfectly possible to become even more literate and have a bigger vocabulary in a second language than it is in the mother tongue, because particularly among young children, bilingualism is frequent. And so I don't know what the caller's data is on that, but my sense is you do not want to hold foreign language children back. And you don't need to if, as Core Knowledge recommends, you start really early in a good preschool, mm-hmm. a good academic preschool.
And what about her point that it's important that funding for bilingual education programs, making sure that students who speak another tongue, that's what they learned, should be able to have their basic instruction done in their native language and then move on from that?
Well, that's it. That was the theory. And the problem was that there wasn't enough bi in the bilingual. And so children didn't learn English very well. And I think you need to talk to a professional linguist about that question. I simply am not an expert in it.
What about second languages, though? You do write about those in this article. Does that help us increase our vocabulary? Does it help us do better on test scores?
Well, certainly, if the languages are Greek and Latin, they certainly do. I just mentioned earlier the word annihilate. And, of course, if you know Latin and you say, aha, nihil, nothing. So they were nothinged, as it were.
Yes.
That helps, of course, and I unfortunately, as a elementary high school student, I never did have Greek, and so I'm a little handicapped in that way. But yes, I mean, those things do help. But on the whole, the roots of words don't always end up. Take the word commute. I was fascinated to discover that a commuter, somebody who comes into town from the suburbs or outlying places, and that's what a commuter is. But the origin of the word is something like a discount.
A discount.
So what is the connection between being a commuter and being a discounted? And if you think of the word, of the term commute, a sentence, a prison sentence, it means you're taking off things. And so what commuters used to do, that is people who came into the city regularly, they got a discount for their on the toll roads. And those, that's why they were called commuters, because they got discounts. I was fascinated by that little bit of obscure lore, but I think it goes to illustrate that you can't use necessarily the etymology of a word to determine what it means now. You really need to learn the connotations of the living language now from its use in context. And if you are familiar with the context, you'll learn it a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Camille, for your call. Nate in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was fortunate enough to be on the board of directors of a charter school that adopted the Core Knowledge curriculum here in the Fox Valley. And what this man has to offer is so much beyond just the vocabulary issue. The Core Knowledge curriculum and the Core Knowledge program is by far and away head and shoulders above anything else that's on the educational scene and has been for decades. That school, the charter school that adopted the Core Knowledge curriculum, it has been the top score, top rank on the tests since the first year that it was opened. It regularly outperforms every other school in the Fox Valley by a ton. But I just want to make a very simple point. The most important thing that the Core Knowledge curriculum does is it has high standards and high expectations, both for the parents and for the students. You can cut through all the BS on the problems with education with a simple observation. Americans are not working hard enough. We do not expect enough of our kids. We do not put enough time in on homework. We do not have an expectation of excellence for our children. And we don't make them work both in the classroom and at home. If you look at how much time teenagers are spending on Facebook and on video games versus homework, it's probably 5-1. And the level of disengagement by parents in their children's education is actually mind-blowing.
Professor Hirsch.
Well, I'm certainly grateful. Thank you so much for the plug for Core Knowledge. And I think it's a very good point. We've been talking about words and vocabularies, but my general point in that article, and of course it fits in with the Core Knowledge schools, my general point was that vocabulary is a side product of knowledge. That is, it's human beings generally use words as their means of learning and doing and communicating. And the words pertain to things. So the general point is, if you want a big vocabulary, if you want a lot of words, you have to know a lot of things. And the Core Knowledge schools, of course, were always focused on the idea of, well, we should decide what the most important things are to learn in our society today, in our national community. And so it's not surprising that the Core Knowledge students should have bigger vocabularies and do well on reading tests, because, in fact, they're learning more things.
Nate, thanks for the call. Ted in Janesville. Hi, Ted.
So I know that Wisconsin has recently adopted the Common Core curriculum. I don't know if there's a relationship between the Core Knowledge and the Common Core curriculum, but one of the aspects is a dramatic increase in nonfiction reading. And I've got two small kids who are in grade school, and a concern of mine is that they're going to be reading a lot of dry, fact-based literature rather than stuff that stimulates their imagination, engages them, and stimulates them. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, nonfiction is a pretty big category, And fiction is a pretty big category, and there's really bad stuff in both of those categories, as you know. So just because, and right now, there's a great proportion of fiction that's being read in language arts and across the curriculum. And most of that stuff is not very good, and it doesn't impart very much knowledge, and it doesn't in obviously, it hasn't worked in raising knowledge and vocabulary levels. And I think what the writers of the Common Core, general standards, they're not a curriculum, were trying to do was generally to relate competence to knowledge. And I think the requirement of works, by the way, it didn't say just dry nonfiction. It said specifically history and science and the arts. As topics, but I think the distinction between fiction and nonfiction is a bit overblown. If you think of Moby Dick, do we want to call that a work of fiction? I mean, there are endless chapters about the details of whaling in Moby Dick that, in any ordinary context, would be called nonfiction, and would be called informational text. And I would say that fiction that isn't somehow telling you truths about the natural or the human world is not very good fiction. And nonfiction, which isn't presented in a lively and, for young children, narrative way, is not very good nonfiction. So the issue, I think, is more quality than genre. And the issue is knowledge also more than genre. Knowledge is the overarching thing, depending on whether it be fiction or nonfiction. And let me just add one other point on that score, because it's a very important one with these Common Core things looming, and that is core knowledge, language arts. We have a language arts program, and it coincides with Common Core, and people love it. It has plenty of good nonfiction in it. Kids love to learn about kings and queens and towns and so on. And really, vapid stories are not very good just because they're fictional.
Hmm. What about an interest that you have to have, though, in whatever the knowledge is that you're accumulating? You mentioned Moby Dick, and I think one of the reasons that I've never been able to get through Moby Dick, quite frankly, is because of the detailed descriptions about whaling. It just doesn't interest me very much. So what do you do about that?
Well, you don't read it. I don't know. I mean, it isn't as though whaling is an absolutely requisite for getting along in the modern world. And maybe I should have used a better example. Well, if we stick to so-called American literature, what do you call Thoreau's Walden? Is that fiction or nonfiction? It's a classic of American literature, yet it's nonfiction.
Right.
And Emerson's essays are certainly nonfiction, but they're classics of American literature. So I think one has to talk about a specific curriculum. And the opponents of the core standards have been drumming up a lot of notions that we're going to be throwing out Charlotte's Web and putting in menus and tax codes. And I think a little discretion in how you arrange your curriculum is important, no matter what the genres are.
So you might skip the tax codes?
I would skip the tax codes.
So would I. Ted, thanks very much for the call. Ray in Eau Claire, hi.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen. Thank you, Professor Hirsch, for joining us on public radio. I was just scanning the jacket here of a delightful movie, looking for perhaps your name as a consultant. If not, I can't find it, but you should have been there. It's called Aquila and the Bee, and it's a story of an 11-year-old girl, African-American, from a rather hard home life in the Los Angeles area, who is encouraged by teachers and a university professor to participate in the National Spelling Bee. And all the the wonderful standards that Nate, two callers ago, listed are very much underscored in all the adversity that she overcomes and all the dedication. So I'd like to recommend that movie called Akeelah, A-K-L-E-E-L-H, and the Bee. It's a 2006 movie, just delightfully inspirational. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Edie Hirsch. He has an article. We're going into all kinds of different areas, but the article that really caught our attention is in the City Journal Winter 2013. That City Journal Winter 2013 is the edition, and it's titled A Wealth of Words. The key to increasing upward mobility is expanding vocabulary. He writes, there's a positive correlation between a student's vocabulary size in grade 12 and the likelihood that she will graduate from college and her future level of income. I want to ask about math scores, too, because the disparity evidently isn't quite as great. And why is that? We'll ask Professor Hirsch about that, and welcome more of your phone calls. There are many of them. One line open if you've been trying to get through. Now is your opportunity. 800-486-8655 would be our number. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org, and we'll be returning to your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's our January book club. Following the news from National Public Radio, Kate Chopin's The Awakening is the book that we'll be talking about. And our guests will include our regular book reviewer, Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison. And Emily Toth will also join us, who is a Kate Chopin biographer, professor of English at Louisiana State University. To Jim in Lake Geneva next. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Wonderful show. I'm in full agreement with just about everybody I've heard talk so far. And I want to articulate my definitely my favorite word. It goes along with annihilation. I read a lot when I was a kid, and I think it's very important to read a lot. Read to your kids. My mom read to me voraciously for probably a year or two. She was a single mom, and I grew up listening to her read. And then when I was in grammar school back then, they don't do so much any longer. They propagated reading among students, and one of the things was if you read 10 books at the summer book club, you were a scholar. If you read 25 books, you're a professor. And if you read 50 books, I used to go shoot for the highest. You get a little mimeographed sheet that said you read 50 books during the summer. And what I chose was historical fiction. And I agree. I want to read The Tax Code. And if you didn't want to read Moby Dick, I liked Moby Dick because I used to read about undersea explorers and Kit Carson, and that transferred into travel and world going places. I had to go see Yellowstone Park because Kit Carson discovered Yellowstone Park. And I learned that from a book. And
right.
World War II stuff and that sort of thing. But whatever your interests are, you can find historical fiction. And textbooks sometimes are boring and dry, but you can find something in both. But it's very important to read, and I think that's exactly what your guest is talking about. To build your vocabulary, you need to read. And that way you can articulate, you expand your horizons. I mean, just that word articulate. Think of all the things you can say. You have a lot of information just in that one word. How long does it take to describe what articulation is? Well, it's talking about a lot of things. You describe things in detail. I mean, two sentences just for one word and saves a lot of RAM. Like you said, you don't have a lot of things to remember. If you remember words to describe a lot of things, you can describe a lot more things and have a lot more information in your mind by knowing more words, and that comes from reading. So that's what I had to say.
Well, thank you for what you had to say, Professor Hirsch.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that's the way people do enlarge their vocabularies, primarily through reading. But there, in the early grades, you can't read very well because your mind is being taxed with the problem of decode. So what happens in the early grades is that you should be read aloud too. Listening is the same as reading in a way. I mean, I don't know whether your guests know it, but silent reading is not totally silent. There was an argument about whether you actually heard what you are reading, and now it's widely accepted. It's a consensus that, yes, even when you're skimming, there's a bit of subarticulation of you actually, the phonic part of language is there. So listening is terribly important, and being read aloud to is terribly important in those early ages, the way the caller's mother did for him, terribly important. But then later on, the richness of vocabulary in the written word is much greater. Again, psychologists have counted these words and found out that even in highly educated speech, even in a program like this one, the richness of vocabulary is much denser in the written word than it is in spoken word.
Could we talk about math for a moment? You include studies that show that the disparity is not as great among disadvantaged students in math as it is in language arts. How do you explain that? How does that fit into the whole pattern of textbooks in the 30s and the 20s? And what's going on with that?
There are two points about math. One is that it is not as predictive. The one that I emphasize in that article is that it's only about half as predictive, the military find, of competence as general knowledge and vocabulary, which would be expected. But on the other hand, it is highly predictive, and it certainly is necessary if you're going to take up one of the technological professions. But the other point about math is, why is there less of a gap between advantaged and disadvantaged students in the field of math than in language? And that one is pretty clear, because math is a school subject. It has a definite curriculum. The tests are based on that curriculum, and if you master that curriculum, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, you can do well. In language, the situation is rather different, because what you are learning outside of school is so determinative, and it's, in fact, there are people in the education world who are strict social determinists. They think that low verbal scores are correlated with poverty. Well, they are correlated, and the whole aim of schooling is to lessen the gap between students. And I think the way to do it is to have, as I've advocated for many years, a coherent knowledge-based curriculum.
Thank you, Jim, for your call. Nancy is next in. Where are you from, Nancy?
I'm from Wabasha, Minnesota.
Wabasha, Minnesota. Hi.
Yes. Hi. I'd like to tell you about a very happy experience that had to do with words. My father, a retired pastor, died at age 90 in 2001, and he lived with us his last 6 years. One of the things that we did was to take a word and look it up in the hymnal. And the one that I remember the most was the word light, L-I-G-H-T, and especially as it referred to God as light. And we'd go through the hymnal, and it was just amazing how many times that we found the word light in the hymnal and in the hymns. And it was delightful. And even now, as we sing hymns in church, that whenever I see that word light, it just jumps out at me, not only the meaning of God being light, but the very happy and sweet memories of seeing this word in the hymnal with my dad. It was just some of my happiest, most precious memories have to do with words and my dad.
Oh, it's a lovely story. Professor Hirsch.
Thank you so much for that. And God is light. I think we would call it I would call it a metaphor. And one of the great delights, and particularly in my former life, I was an English teacher, and as a student, both as a teacher and a student, learning about the metaphorical uses of language. After all, when I've been talking about knowledge and things being correlated with vocabulary, but words are things too, and learning about words and about the magical metaphorical use of words is knowledge as well. And thanks to the caller.
Yes, and don't you just love it she was thinking about the word light in the business that we're in. I just love it when this happens, and it happens all the time, that you'll be learning something new about some part of the world or some issue, and all of a sudden, because you've learned that, everything else kind of points in that direction. So it keeps coming up. Like Dubai. Dubai has come up for a variety of reasons the last couple of weeks. And when you learn something about an area, all of a sudden it opens you up to learning so much more about the same thing, because there it is. It's all around you all of a sudden. Have you noticed that?
Yes. And of course, again, the more things you know, the more words you know, the more often that happens.
Right. Yeah, I love it when that happens. Nancy, thanks for the call. We go to Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. Two-part question. First, I've taken a myriad of intelligence tests, but they gave me one a number of years ago where it had like 52 vocabulary words of escalating difficulty and 30 problem-solving examples. And I always found that the most fascinating because it was the most unusual. I'm wondering if you're familiar with that test at all. But secondly, I'm a fan of Alfie Cohen, and he seems to be of the philosophy that for real young students, loading them down with homework is kind of a detriment to their development as social beings and as people. And he's more of the philosophy that what we need to improve education is a little less homework and a whole lot less poverty. And I'm wondering if your guest has any comments on either of those questions.
Well, I know Alfie Cohn's work, and my sentiment is different. I think that we need more rigorous schooling in order to overcome poverty. It isn't as though you could overcome poverty just by fiat and say, okay, everybody's going to be well off and have well-educated parents and grow up in a language-rich home. Because the government does something, I think it's well known that, and in fact, that's kind of the subject matter of my article, is that the route out of poverty is a non-Alfie Cohn kind of education. I mean, there were two failures, I think, in the ideas behind American education. And Alfie Cohn represents what I consider to be one of them, and that is the first failure is a romantic naturalism. That is, if you let the individual child grow, that they'll automatically acquire what they need in the modern world. So that's the naturalistic tendency. The other tendency is a kind of how-to-ism, that we don't need to learn things. We need to learn how to think critically and how to problem solve as an abstract operation. And that how-to-ism, I think, is even more pernicious because both of those strands in American educational thought are what I would call anti-intellectual. They're anti-bookish. Keep young children away from books and so on. And that's a powerful strand in American intellectual history, as Richard Hofstadter, the great intellectual historian, pointed out. He had this book called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, and he devotes the last chapter of that book to this romantic tradition of American education. So I'm sympathetic to the caller. I mean, I have to say, I was strongly influenced by those ideas myself as a parent. But I've come to feel that if we want social justice, more social justice in this country, we had better get down to work. And by the way, we need to get down to work on a rather definite and coherent knowledge-based curriculum.
Thanks, Kelly, for the call. Running out of time, we have about 45 seconds. Sarah in Madison, hi. Sarah, I got to press the button. Hi, Sarah. Oh, no, the button's kind of there we go. Okay, we're okay now. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to further add to that topic about poverty and education, because there is a lot of research showing that poverty actually affects the brain and creates hormonal changes that affect students' ability to learn. So I think it's kind of a catch-22, or it's kind of there's a problem in the logic that just because you offer a good curriculum, the students will be able to learn well and come out of poverty. And there are programs that have been shown by research to be effective by bringing families out of poverty, and it's been had an effective impact on students' learning. So providing jobs to parents, providing health care, the basic needs that families have. So I don't see those as being mutually exclusive. Just because you're improving the curriculum doesn't mean you also don't need to provide the financial and basic life needs in order for students to learn well.
Thank you, Sarah, very much for the call. We'll leave it at that. Professor Edie Hirsch, thank you very much for being with us.
Well,
interesting hour.
Thank you for having me, indeed.
Professor Edie Hirsch, our guest, the article we refer to, if you'd like to read it, is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program.